This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Cases of COVID-19 are starting to explode inside North Carolina's prisons. 62 people at a federal correctional complex in Butner have tested positive, according to the News and Observer. It's the highest number of any prison in the country. Overcrowding and understaffing has public health officials concerned that prisons, jails, and detention centers will become the next epicenters of the outbreak. And advocates warn that when it comes to disease, what happens in prisons is never confined within those walls. Joe Neff is a staff writer with the Marshall Project, a nonprofit news organization covering the criminal justice system. He's been reporting on the pandemic and its interplay with prisons, and he joins us now. Joe, welcome back.
It's good to be here, Frank.
Talk about Butner. I mean, how can we explain what's going on there? Why are the infection rates jumping so dramatically?
Well, you have to think of prisons or jails like a cruise ship or a nursing home. You have a confined population. The people can't get up and walk. They can't walk out the gate because they're incarcerated. And if the virus gets in the prison, we've seen it's incredibly infectious and moves very easily from place to place, from person to person. And in jails and prisons, people are cheek by jowl. It's impossible to socially isolate yourself, to socially distance yourself by that 6 foot margin that all the doctors say we should be using. So once it gets in, once the virus gets into a closed facility, it's like a Petri dish.
Anything particular to Butner? It does seem to be an outlier, even among, at least in federal prisons. I just wonder if we know anything about that.
I do know a bit about that because at many of the federal prisons, like at Oakdale in Louisiana, where we've had 5 inmates die, they've stopped testing. So they have something like 37 people in the hospital right now, 12 of them on ventilators from that one prison. But the inmates and staff have told us that management says we're all infected. We're just assuming. We all have it, so we're not testing anymore. So the fact that you get these high numbers from Butner is really alarming. But at other places, including Elkton in Ohio, they've just stopped testing.
And I guess that might lead to another question about transparency in general, about whether we can know about the infections in our jails and prisons.
Well, it's the Marshall Project has been trying to collect weekly information from prisons about how many tests they do, and how many inmates have tested positive. Like in North Carolina, they've done 160 tests, and as of this morning, there were 12 positive cases. Now, they're not releasing any information about how many guards are tested or how many correctional officers test positive. So we don't know the numbers among the staff.
We should, at this point, make a distinction between jails and prisons. It's really relevant when we're talking about the spread of this disease, isn't it?
Absolutely, because I think commonly people use those words interchangeably, but in this context, they're very different. Prisons, people go in and they've been sentenced for their crime, and they generally spend sentences that measure in years, and the population is generally stable. In jails, people go in and out all the time. You might get picked up for a shoplifting charge. You go to the jail, they book you in, you bail out. The turnover in jails is roughly 25% a week. So meaning at the end of a month, you've essentially seen the entire population turnover. So it's very transient. And people who come out of jails when they're bailed out or released pretrial go right back into the community. So they are potentially real hot spots.
What have you heard regarding the availability of personal protective equipment in jails and prisons?
Well, I've heard that there are two things. You get the guidance from the top saying we're going to provide personal protective equipment to all the staff, and we're going to get them masks. And then you talk to the staff or officers or inmates, and they're like, well, no, they don't have. None of the staff are wearing masks, or very few. So It's very unclear. It's very fluid. I talked with the federal correctional officer yesterday who said that his facility in Ohio finally got a big shipment, and they're good for a couple months for PPE. Other prisons have nothing.
I'm talking with Joe Neff of the Marshall Project. Throughout the program, we're going to hear from those who are affected in the prison system. North Carolina Department of Public Safety was unable to process our interview requests for inmates and staff for this program. But we did receive this message from a listener in Western North Carolina worried about an incarcerated loved one.
Seems like there's a lot of talk about help and promises and people, oh, we're going to do this, we're going to do that. But, you know, there's no action being taken. Where's the action behind your promise, you know? We need to see something. I don't see anything happening. You, oh, we're going to give them face masks. Well, where the heck are they? Where are those face masks? I talk to my husband every day, sometimes twice a day. He ain't seen a face mask. I just don't know what else to do. And there is nobody else going to give him a voice, you know, but me.
But Stephanie, we'll hear more from her and others throughout this program. Right now I'm talking to Joe Neff from the Marshall Project. Joe, so that speaks to some of the personal experience that people are having over and against some of the official statements about protection. But what about the demographics? These are people, are they generally more at risk than the average person?
I would think so, partly that people in jails tend to have, and prisons, tend to have higher rates of chronic diseases. High blood pressure, very bad for COVID. Hepatitis, mental illness. They may not have taken really good care of themselves in their lives. Substance abuse. And it presents in general a weaker profile of a person, and so it makes them more exposed.
We've heard from former inmates concerned about the spread of this virus. Here's a message from Tony Carrington.
You're in a dorm related to close to 40 people sometimes with double bunking. They're going to be overwhelmed with even pertaining to one camp. If one camp get it, meaning one camp consists of 300 to 400 people in the camp. So just imagine if one can't get it and there's not enough adequate health care. They're literally doomed because people, you know, already in the underlying diagnosis with, you know, high blood pressure, hypertension, whatever they have, you know, plus especially long-timers that's been in there for so many years that had smoked and then caught in, like, you know, some type of throat cancer or whatever. I can't even really explain what they're going to go through because the system is not built to protect. It's built to protect people from the individuals locked in prison. Do you get what I'm saying?
Tony Carrington, who was incarcerated in North Carolina facilities. I'm here with Joe Neff of the Marshall Project. So, Joe, it gets at what you were talking about earlier, but I think sometimes if we think about prisons, we think about people isolated in cells, you know, by themselves, maybe with another inmate. But a lot of particularly the lower security facilities are dormitory-style camps, right?
Oh, yeah. They're dormitory-style camps. In the federal system, sometimes they are, you might have a cubicle with six people in it and walls that come up to maybe 4 feet high, and it's open. Other prisons, it just looks like what you see in the pictures from the Javits Center in New York, rows and rows of bunks 3 feet apart. So you cannot social distance in a place like that. Plus you have fans or the air conditioning moving the air all around, and they're just designed to spread an infectious disease like this.
And besides corrections officers and other staff, who else is going in and out of prisons?
Well, you have vendors who are supplying food or health care or medical care. You have lawyers going in and out to talk to their clients. Now, most of those have been in most facilities. That's now being done by phone or Zoom. You also have volunteers going in and out, people who want to teach inmates or preach to inmates and counsel them. So there's just all these people going in and out. Now, much of that outside traffic is shut down. Families can't go visit, and most facilities don't allow volunteers in at this point. But you still have the staff going in and out every day.
Joe, I know the Marshall Project is reporting on growing unrest in prisons among the staff, dissatisfaction among corrections officers, the changes in how order is being maintained. What are you hearing and what changes do you expect?
Oh, boy. I think that the staff at these prisons are just worried about there. There's two big worries that I hear from the staff is that they're going to catch the virus in the jail or prison, come home and bring it to their family. And I think that that is going to exacerbate short staffing, which is already a big problem in many places. North Carolina has, I think, about 20% of its staff vacant in the prison. And if that gets any worse, it's just harder to run a prison with a short staff. In some states, Mississippi, for example, they're half of, you know, or Alabama, half of their staff is vacant. So how do you actually maintain order in prisons that are maybe 150% crowded at their capacity and the staff is down 50%? And that creates the fear among those people incarcerated that, is there enough people to keep us safe?
To keep them safe. I'm going to cut it off here and I'm going to come back. Joe Neff of the Marshall Project is going to stay with us on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, as we talk about COVID-19 and our prison system. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. As the COVID-19 pandemic sweeps across the globe, public health experts offer concrete guidance on avoiding the virus. Practice vigilant hand washing, clean high-touch surfaces, and most importantly, of course, keep away from other people. But for inmates in jails and prisons, none of these measures is really possible. And as more and more North Carolina inmates have tested positive for the disease, their families and advocates are sounding the alarm. We've heard from former inmates and those directly affected by the outbreaks inside, like Stephanie, who's worried about her incarcerated husband.
6 to 8 year sentence. It's what he got for being a drug addict. And it's time for him to come home and not in a friggin' body bag.
As we continue our examination of mass incarceration during this public health crisis, Joe Neff is still with us, a staff writer with the Marshall Project who's been reporting on COVID-19 and incarceration. And joining us now is Christy Puckett-Williams. She's the statewide campaign for Smart Justice Manager for the ACLU of North Carolina. Christy, welcome.
Hey, Frank, how are you?
Well, I'm fine, but take us inside a jail or a prison, because I want to get a picture of sort of who's getting in and other people who, you know, need to go in to help inmates and work with inmates.
Well, I mean, you know, across this country, nearly 2 million people go to sleep behind bars each night, Frank. So it varies. Everyone is affected and impacted by incarceration, especially mass incarceration in this country. And so at the ACLU of North Carolina, we've been working to decrease the number of people who are incarcerated across the board and fight racism that we know exists within our criminal legal system. And so inside of jails and prisons, much of what you heard Jeff say is we have heard reports of people not having soap or warm water to do the simple yet critical things that the CDC recommends. So that is the state right now, people not having access to the things and be able to take measures that would keep themselves safe.
Give us a sense of some of the other things that we might not think about, the ways in which prisons are organized to make things essentially less sanitary and more difficult in this crisis.
Oh, goodness. So the first thing that I think of is the CDC recommends that we close the lid when we flush our toilets so that fecalized COVID that becomes aerosolized is not sprayed all across our bathrooms when we use the bathroom. And so you don't have the ability to do that inside of a jail or prison. There isn't a lid that you can shut. We oftentimes are hearing of there being toilet paper shortages, so people are having to use the items that they would use to shower and bathe and cleanse themselves with to use when they go to the restroom.
Well, inmates are doing whatever they can to protect themselves, as you suggest. We heard actually from the mother of an inmate telling us about her concerns.
To me, it's frustrating because I asked him the other day, and his birthday is today, and I asked him last night when we talked, I said, you know, you made choices. Now you have to live with the choices that you made. I said, but it's not fair to you that we have this virus going around and no one is trying to protect you, because I know if you were home, you would be protecting yourself as well as making sure your kids are being protected as well. I said, but who protects you while you're in there? And he said, he told me, he said, Mom, no one protects us. He said, we got to do what we got to do. He takes a sock and put over the telephone and use the telephones, and he's always used his own flip-flops with socks on, but he has no protection in there.
So that's Tiffany sharing some of her frustrations and her understanding of what's going on inside. If you are directly affected by the prison system and want to share your story, you can leave us a voicemail at 919-980-5419. 919-980-5419. Christy, what are you hearing from families?
What you just heard, Frank. Essentially, families are terrified. The people inside are terrified. They know that they are at greater risk. Their families know that they're at greater risk. When we talk about people in jails, oftentimes those are people who were too poor to purchase their freedom from the government, right, from the state. They were unable to afford a bail that was set. And simply because they are poor, people being held pretrial are being put at risk for COVID simply because they're poor, right? And so that is what we see happening. We see families not able to afford because of COVID and their loss of income being able to put money on the books so that people can call home, so that people can have commissary, so that their family can purchase soap and extra cleansing items for themselves. And so that puts a heavy strain on a family, as well as not being able to bail their family member out.
Well, we should talk more about that, the communication and even the ability to bail out or do some of those things. First of all, it's expensive to make phone calls to and from prison, right? I mean, that's one of the things that we don't think about normally on the outside here. But just trying to get communication when it's permitted is extremely expensive. And now you're talking about it during, you know, what could be the worst depression since the 1930s. And the most vulnerable people have the least amount of money and the least capacity to afford this.
Yeah, it's a dire, dire situation. Communication to the outside world is such a necessity. That is the number one thing that a jail or a prison can do when we talk about safety and safety of officers and safety of the people that are incarcerated. The number one measure that studies show that a detention center can take is to provide communication, unfettered communication to family members so that they can have that connection to the outside world. What they see on TV is limited. If they are able to afford a subscription to the newspaper is how they can keep up with the daily news. But what you watch is dictated by that detention officer, that correctional officer in that day room, you know. And so you may not see the news. They may not know how bad it is. So they need that connection to their family so that they understand that they should be taking measures.
Well, I want to go back to Stephanie, who is a caller from Western North Carolina, and her husband and son are currently incarcerated.
I'm just scared. I'm scared, and I don't know what to do. I don't know how to pay my rent. I don't know how to pay the phone bill. You know, and my husband, if he gets sick in prison, how do you – he has to pay to go see a doctor. You know, you have to pay medical. You know, if you've got a fever or anything like that, you have to pay. You know, some of the inmates won't even go to write a sick call because they have to pay.
I want to thank Stephanie for calling in and talking with us, and the other callers also who offered to share their stories. And if you're directly affected by the carceral system and want to share your story, you can leave us a voicemail at 919-980-5419. 919-980-5419. I'm here with Joe Neff of the Marshall Project and Christy Puckett-Williams of the ACLU. Joe, tell us about medical costs in prisons and some of the other costs, but start with the medical costs. The inmates are paying for their own care.
Yeah, many facilities across the country, not all, but many have a copay. So if you want to go see a nurse, you want to go see a doctor, you have to pay a copay. It may be $2 or $4, but if you don't have any money in your commissary account, if you're not working, or even if you are working, you may be making 10 cents an hour, 25 cents an hour. So that copay can be a deterrent. In this case, it could be a very deadly deterrent. There are many states that have waived the copay at this point, but not all. But it's their message has been sent over the years to discourage appointments with the clinic or the prison infirmary.
Well, I want to bring another participant into our conversation now. Chuck Manning is with us. He's the director of the Welcome Home Program and lead peer support specialist for the reentry of early release detainees for the City of Durham's COVID-19 Task Force. Chuck, welcome to the State of Things.
Hey, thank you all for having me.
Chuck, I know you're welcoming an early release today. Tell us about preparations you're making for this reentry.
So, with early release and COVID-19 epidemic really being a high priority for the City of Durham, we have put together a team of individuals who are working around specifically the reentry process for these individuals. So we're partnered with the local reentry council. We're also partnered with the Religious Coalition for Nonviolent Durham, Durham CAN, and some other entities that are working around this this issue that we have. For one, we're quarantining each early release individual, so we're getting a list directly from DPS of all individuals who have qualified for the early release. So these individuals fall under certain criteria. So they are 65 and above, they've done 3/4 of their time, and they do not have violent charges. So what we're doing, we have actually gotten some funding thanks to attorney Daniel Bowes, who works for the county justice system here in Durham. And we're going to assist these individuals in quarantining for 14 days once they're released. And this, by doing this, we'll be kind of reassuring that individuals who are incarcerated, who may not have had the access to be tested, will have 14 days of quarantine time prior to them reconnecting with family, friends, and things of that nature. So we will be actually paying for a hotel facility. We also have a doctor who is on our team, and he runs a FIT program here in Durham. And the FIT program is through the county of Durham, and they address medical issues, high blood pressure, diabetes, individuals who are coming home under these conditions, they assist them. So with the COVID-19, he has been giving us some great guidance as far as protocol to kind of ensure that this isn't transmitted from prison to society.
Well, Joe Neff at the Marshall Project, I'm sorry, Jack, I want to ask Joe a question, though, just sort of generally, maybe statewide, to get a picture of these early releases. I know Durham County is one, but if you know kind of what the, you know, what are the objectives and the numbers that we might be looking at, Joe Neff?
Well, there really haven't been very many releases on an expedited basis because of COVID-19. You have, to some activists gave a list of 419 inmates over 60 who spent significant time in the system, have low numbers of, have behaved well in terms of the low number of disciplinary. And I think it might be the first one out of prison off this list might be the one that my other guest is going to greet, because so far there's been one off this list that's coming out, and it's an effort between the DA, the Durham District Attorney, Satana DeBerry, and the defense bar. The people who put together the list sent it to Governor Cooper, and they said they've gotten no response for that.
Christy Puckett-Williams, Christy, I want to ask you a question about releasing, about these releases, because it does seem to be a solution that law enforcement and justice officials are turning to. But what does that say about who's being booked and who's being incarcerated and who's not?
Well, we know overwhelmingly across the country, but especially and including North Carolina, it's black, brown, and poor people, hands down.
What is it? And so if we look at this, you know, because there's been some backlash as well about sort of, you know, releasing as this is an answer or this is not an answer, quite a bit of pushback. How do you feel about this response, Christy?
That this is not the answer? Well, I mean, to me, it's a public health concern. Over 95% of people who are incarcerated will eventually return to their communities, and their health problems and needs often follow along. So the communities in which they return to tend to be overwhelmingly low-income communities of color. They often lack adequate health care resources, and for those reasons, it's something that we all have to be concerned about. Public health, corrections health is public health.
Well, I want to move to another caller right along those lines to talk about public health and what happens once you're released, because, Chuck, as you pointed out, you're going to go back into isolation. I want to listen to a call from a former inmate, Daryl Scales, and I'll ask you both to talk about this, about these concerns about isolation from Daryl.
The last thing you want to do when you're in prison is kind of be separate. Because, you know, once you're together and you get some type of camaraderie going on, your days go by quicker. And, you know, you don't want to be in a cell by yourself for 23 hours a day.
Daryl Scales, a former inmate of the North Carolina prison system, talking about going in isolation within the prison. I'm talking to Chuck Manning and Christy Puckett-Williams, along with Joe Neff from the Marshall Project. Chuck, what do you hear in that call from Daryl?
Yes, so that's why... with the Welcome Home program, it is centered around peer support. Peer support is basically taking individuals who have lived experience. I myself have been in and out of jail and prison since the age of 11. You heard from my colleague, Tony Carrington. He's done over 15 years in prison. We utilize that lived experience in assisting individuals in accomplishing short-term goals, but also creating a sense of accountability. And like Daryl was just saying, the days do go by quicker when you have somebody that you can relate to, somebody who has actually slept on those bunks and took showers with multiple numbers of men and had to walk the yard and hit the weight pile and, you know, eat from the mess hall. You need individuals like that to kind of learn from, especially in the immediate transition process from prison to society. So we are incorporating with the 14 days that are being paid for the hotel rooms. Tony, myself, and Sandra Lassiter, who is another colleague of mine, for the women, we will be doing peer support with these individuals. It's a little different now because of COVID-19 as far as one-on-one, you know, and assisting people, giving them rides and things of that nature. But we do have a protocol to keep ourselves safe and that individual. Mask on at all times, gloves, staying 6 feet away from the individual. We're also doing Google Duo. Making phone calls, we're connecting with them 3 to 4 times a day through text, just to keep up with the individuals and keep them encouraged and keep them knowledgeable of how important it is to stay to yourself for those first 14 days coming home.
Well, Christy, many people obviously all over are feeling isolated and helpless right now. I wonder if you can give us some insight into how a pandemic like this affects the mental health of those who are incarcerated.
Well, incarceration itself is humiliating, dehumanizing, and oftentimes a dangerous experience in the best of circumstances. And so people who already have underlying mental health conditions are overrepresented in a jail or prison population. And so we know that what Daryl, the caller, described was solitary confinement. And that is oftentimes going to be a detention center's answer to an issue like COVID, which is 23 and a half hour a day lockdown, which we know is torturous to people, right? That is why it is good for people to be released and to self-quarantine and to quarantine in the community, because they have the liberation and the liberty to do what they see fit. If they need hand sanitizer, they have access to that hand sanitizer. They want to take 10 showers a day, they can, whenever they want to. They can use the bathroom when they want to. They can change their clothes. They can have new sheets. You know, all of those things that we take for granted are not taken for granted for people who are living in the constant state of a carceral system.
Chuck, what are some of the ways the Welcome Home Project will address the psychological and social needs? You talk about some ways of connecting, but will there be also counseling as part of this?
Yes. So, like I said, we're partnered with various groups here in Durham, Local Reentry Council being one. The Welcome Home Program has been going for close to 2 years now. And from day one, we saw that mental illness, substance disorder, things of that nature have been at the forefront. Dual diagnosis, you may have both. My team and myself, we're well connected with various mental health facilities and partners here in Durham. So we outsource and we connect those individuals with all wraparound sources, food banks, mental health. We connect them with employment, training, everything that an individual would need to successfully transition back into society. We try to connect those individuals.
Chuck Manning. Chuck Manning is the director of the Welcome Home Program. Chuck, thank you so much for talking with us.
Yes, no problem.
A lead peer support specialist for reentry for early release detainees for the city of Durham, Christy Puckett-Williams, statewide campaign for Smart Justice Manager at ACLU North Carolina. Thanks so much. North Carolina Supreme Court Chief Justice Cherry Beasley is next on The State of Things. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stasio. Across the nation, prisons are scrambling to keep inmates and staff safe. We heard from former inmates and the loved ones of those facing disease from the inside. Now we'll turn our discussion to preventative measures. Last week, North Carolina Supreme Court Chief Justice Cherry Beasley announced that court proceedings would be postponed until June 1st. And while you can still pay that speeding ticket online, other parts of the justice system are feeling the ripple effects of that freeze. And here to tell us more is Chief Justice Cherry Beasley on The State of Things. Hello, Chief Justice Beasley. On The State of Things today, talking to Chief Justice Cherry Beasley, talking about some of the changes in our court system as we suspend. We've lost that line. We'll make another connection as we try to make connections with the court system, but also suspending some of that activity. And I think there's been a lot of confusion about what is and what is not going to continue through the courts. Obviously, there's an effort to limit as much as possible the number of people who have to enter the same room for a legal proceeding, for preliminary proceedings or other court efforts. So suspending activity until June 1st does not mean that the criminal justice system has ground to a halt completely. And Chief Justice Cherry Beasley is here to tell us more. Chief Justice Beasley, welcome to The State of Things.
Hi, Frank. Good to be here.
It's good to have you here. Can you spell out some of the directions that you've given to the court now and kind of what is and what is not going to be happening in those courthouses?
It's been very important to me as the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of North Carolina and as the head of the judicial branch, first and foremost, to make sure that our courts are safe. We've worked really hard to try to keep as much traffic as possible out of our courts, and so my first action was to continue as many cases as possible in our courts. And I have entered four orders since that time, the last of which has continued cases until June the 1st. And that's most cases. There are, of course, some exceptions. And the cases where there are the most emergent needs to include domestic violence and bond and bail hearings, as well as allowing local courts to and encouraging them to hear the cases that they can hear safely. So we're excited about the fact that in the last order we are allowing local courts to telecourt, if you will, and so some of those hearings will be done by audio and digital transmissions, and also allowing that for sworn statements that need to have notarization, that those statements be made under penalty of perjury rather than actually in person. So in all of the ways that I have entered my orders, the goal really has been to stop as many people as possible from actually coming into our courts, as well as allowing some of the business to continue as best possible.
And as you suggested, as you said, you've left some of this up to the local courts. Why have you left some of those decisions up to the local courts?
Well, for a host of reasons. It's really important that, these folks, what works in Wake County may not work in Barnett or some of the other rural counties. And, these folks are in control of their courts every single day. And so it's been really important that in many of these areas, the local judges have entered their own administrative orders, which are consistent with my orders. And that seems to have worked out at this point.
Now, some courts have been able to continue. You talked about the remote operations. Is this a good idea? Is this something that could have been done a long time? Is there any real downside to doing some of these proceedings remotely? Obviously, brought on by the COVID-19 virus. But I wonder if there's anything that's lost by doing some of these.
Well, I think many of the ways in which we're having to be creative and ingenious about court proceedings, we will learn a lot about what works and what doesn't work. I'm sure there are many ways in which we will transform our methods of conducting business, which we probably should have been able to do all along. One of the things that I had instituted before the imposition of the pandemic is e-courts. And so certainly if we had had e-courts up and running, so many of our court functions would have been a lot easier and a lot easier for the public to utilize. But the message that I hope people take away today is that we are encouraging them to not come to the courthouse unless they absolutely have to. We're asking them to go to nccourts.org nccourts.gov if they have questions about what's happening in their local areas, and to assure them that they can pay traffic tickets and some other things online. So we're asking that for now so that the courts can be a part of flattening the curve and not risking people's health, to include the court officials as well as the publics, that they stay away from the courts as much as possible.
Now, I'm wondering how some of these orders will affect people who are now being held in jail with no charges. They're unable to pay bond. Are they going to have to wait till June 1st in the county jail because of this freeze?
No. In fact, the bond hearings and other matters, whether they are related to people who are incarcerated or not, the local authorities do have the authority to go forward with a lot of those hearings. In terms of people who are incarcerated in our local jails, the sheriffs and the district attorneys and the judges are evaluating those cases literally day by day. And actually, the populations, as I understand it in our local jail, from most of our counties are actually down these days, and probably down further than, as I'm understanding it from the Sheriff's Association, down lower than they have been in recent years. So we're excited about the fact that local officials tend to keep track of inmates and determining which cases can go forward and can be accelerated anyway, and certainly they're extremely mindful of that as we're experiencing this pandemic.
Now, obviously, everybody understands why these postponements are taking place. It's very clear the reasons for it, but then the question becomes, what happens afterward? How do you catch up on the backlog of cases after these extensions?
Well, we're considering that, and I had an opportunity along with my director of the Administrative Office of the Courts yesterday to make a presentation to the House Committee on COVID-19. And so we are asking for support and funding to make sure that we can be as responsive and as efficient as possible on the other side of the impact of this pandemic. And so we know we'll need more support for temporary employees to help us catch up on the backlog. We know that we will need more emergency judges employed to make sure that we can catch up on the backlog. And so we are already beginning to think about what happens when we come out of this and how can we best serve the public.
Of course, one of the things we might want to consider in this moment is keeping people from entering the process. But I'm wondering what all of this, what kinds of effects you're seeing on law enforcement agencies and how they're having to adapt to all of this.
Well, I think law enforcement is certainly probably a bit overwhelmed by all of this. I mean, it certainly helps when people stay home and they are compliant with the governor's order to do that. But in all the ways that law enforcement have been helpful in supporting local communities all over the state, they've been helpful, and they've also helped to enforce the laws, and also responding to emergencies that don't occur unless we're under a pandemic. So I think it's fair to say, and I'm very grateful to law enforcement as well as our judges and clerks of court and all the folks in our court systems who are really working extensively to make sure that we are meeting our constitutional mandates on the one hand, but also keeping the public safe on the other.
Well, we heard from Henderson County Sheriff's Department about how they're adapting. Let's listen.
We're not seeing as many arrests, and when we do see where typically would maybe arrest would have been made, now there's some citations being written, or if an arrest, if it still requires an arrest to be made and they come before the magistrate, we're seeing some people being released on their own written promise or some people getting unsecured bonds. Those decisions are made through the court system, but the people who we get a security order to house them and that release order states they're under secured bond, we're taking them in just like we did prior to all this and the precautions we set in place, and those people are put on a quarantine for as soon as they get here, and then they're checked daily, and then once that quarantine period's over, then they'll be moved into whatever level of classification housing unit we have. The law is still enforceable. In other words, there are situations that it's officer discretion that he can write a citation or he can take the person to jail. Now, because of the COVID virus and taking precautions, that person, you may not even want them in the patrol car. Does that make any sense?
Captain Todd McCrane, the jail administrator for the Henderson County Sheriff's Department. I'm speaking with Chief Justice Cherry Beasley of the North Carolina Supreme Court, of the North Carolina court system. Cherry Beasley, talk a little bit about the future that you see coming out of this and the way, you know, some of these changes that are emergency changes now might actually enlighten us about ways that we can go forward, changes that we might want to keep in place.
Well, you know, I think in great part, you know, I'm excited about our e-courts, and we had already begun the layout for that program to make sure that technology is more available to people all over the state. And so given the fact that we really need to be more reliant on technology, we're already beginning to see how, once we implement e-courts, how many of our systems will be improved. And I think, you know, the more we do with and conduct hearings by remote audio and visual transmissions, I think the more we will see that can be helpful in a host of ways. I think often we think about the fact that in larger counties, the resources and the buildings may be in closer proximity, but in some of the rural counties, transporting inmates is a little bit more difficult, and so there are a host of ways in which we'll be able to more greatly utilize remote audio and video transmissions. And we're also allowing service of court documents by email right now to keep people reduce the traffic in our courthouses. So I think the more we implement these kinds of changes on an emergency basis, or we'll be able to determine how best to utilize them going forward in the long run.
Well, those certainly are some technological changes, but I'm also thinking about some of the reform movements that have already been underway. And I wonder why, for instance, I know there's a coalition of activists that have asked you to ensure that judges make non-monetary bail the first option unless that person is a flight risk or a danger to the community. And I wonder if that's an order that you feel you can make at this point. I know you wanted to grant a lot of authority to the local jurisdictions, but if that's an order that you feel you can make, and if we will maybe take a look at our bail system and some of the other elements, the technical elements rather than the technological elements of our carceral system.
We had already begun to assess pretrial release conditions and how we should think about pretrial release going forward. We had already implemented a program in the western part of the state that seemed to have been successful, and we're looking forward to continuing that program and assessing differently how bond is set and how pretrial release conditions are set and at what stages lawyers should be engaged. And so we will continue that assessment, and the intention for that program is to go statewide. It's important for us to continue to have those. Even before the pandemic, and in terms of assessing cases now, it is so important for people to understand that now, but even before the pandemic, but I'm sure local judges and sheriffs and DAs and folks are assessing on a case-by-case basis.
I'll tell you what, Chief Justice, here's what I want to do is, at the moment, Chief Justice Beasley, we're going to try to make a better connection with you on the phone. And in the meantime, I will remind everybody that we are talking to the Chief Justice of the North Carolina Supreme Court, Chief Justice Cherry Beasley, about reforms and changes in our criminal justice system, certainly immediate changes that she is making and ordered in our criminal justice system and the way the courts are operating, suspending many cases until June 1st, allowing the most risky and the most dangerous cases to go through. So domestic violence cases will continue in the courts, and some other cases that pose an imminent risk will continue in the courts. Others have been delayed until June 1st. You'll still be able to pay fines, traffic fines, through the courts. And a lot of technology is being used to allow people to connect with the courts remotely. And Chief Justice Beasley, maybe you can repeat for us just a little bit of what you're hoping in terms of reform coming out of this in our carceral system, to get fewer people in jails and prisons, and take a new look at the way we're doing business.
We had already, before the pandemic, begun to assess pretrial release conditions. We had already instituted a program in the western part of our state, which allowed for a different kind of assessment and application of pretrial release conditions, which also assessed and determined when the lawyer might be engaged in that process. And we were already beginning to see some successes around determining pretrial release conditions. And so we will continue that program, and we will continue to analyze and determine how best to determine pretrial release conditions and what resources are needed to make that happen. I think you're right that in a pandemic, we're certainly making assessments very differently about that. And I think it's important for folks to realize that the local judges and DAs and sheriffs are always making those decisions, literally day by day and case by case. And so we really shouldn't assume that because it's not happening in the way that, you know, folks may wish it to happen, that it's not happening. Those assessments are being made, and they were being made before the pandemic. But there's certainly, I mean, everybody appreciates that there's a sense of urgency to reduce the risk of the spread of COVID-19. And so those assessments around release continue to be made daily.
Thank you so much for talking with us, Cherry Beasley, the Chief Justice of the North Carolina Supreme Court. What a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
You can find out more at our website, stateofthings.org. State of Things is produced by Anita Rao, Amanda Magnus, Grant Hollab-Mormon, Kaya Findlay, Stacia Brown, and Jennifer Brookland. Josie Taras is our intern. Jenny Lawson, our technical director. Al Wadarski helped engineer the show today. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.